This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm interviewing Lou Paper, who's the author of a great new book called Perfect. And for those who don't know what that means, the subtitle explains it: Don Larson's Miraculous World Series Game and the Men Who Made It Happen. Hi, Lou. How are you?
I'm great, David. How are you today?
I'm terrific. And I'm looking forward to talking to you about this book. As I grew up in the era just after this occurred, but it was certainly part of my consciousness as a rabid, youthful baseball fan. It's a terrific book, and one that really, I think, captures the essence of baseball in that era, which obviously you're sympathetic to. Can maybe talk a little bit about your history as a baseball fan?
Well, I grew up in Livingston, New Jersey, which is not too far from New York. And my father was a Yankee fan, and he introduced me to the Yankees, so to speak. And so I just became a rabid baseball fan like yourself. I just love the Yankees. There was some chemistry connection there. And so I watched a lot of these guys who are portrayed in this book. Are guys who I watched on television or on my frequent visits to Yankee Stadium. And so I grew up with them. And so to some extent, that was the allure for me of writing this book, because to me, these people represented my youth. And as I say, in some respects were mythical figures because I just remember them on television or at the stadium.
And I guess I should point out to people who are listening, the book is about Don Larson's Perfect Game, which is pitched in the World Series in 1956, was at that time, and still is, the only perfect game ever thrown in the World Series. And what you did in this book is essentially structure the book around the game itself. And obviously, you could tell the story of the perfect game in maybe a chapter. So you took that as a launching pad to go into much more detail and depth about baseball, these players, that era, the history of key players who were in the game. Essentially you did a portrait of a number of the players, but also as you did this, you wove together a portrait of baseball in 1956 and maybe a little bit after. So it's kind of the decade of the 50s.
Well, that's correct. Well, what I did was I certainly wanted to tell the story about Don Larson's perfect game. It's, as you say, not only is it the only perfect game in World Series history, of more than 100 years of World Series history, it's the only no-hit game that's ever been pitched in a World Series ever. And in fact, the only no-hit game that's ever been pitched in any playoff game since they started having playoff series. So it stands as a unique event in baseball history. Everybody who's a baseball fan knows about it, but I wanted to tell something more about the game and find some more details about the game. But I wanted to do more than tell the story about the game. I decided, as you indicate, I wanted to tell the stories of the 19 players who were on the field that day and find out who were these guys, where did they come from, what were their hopes, what were their goals, and how did they find themselves at Yankee Stadium on this historic day on October 8th, 1956. And more importantly, what did they think of this game that stands as a unique event in baseball history? And in the course of doing the research, I not only was able to find out new details about the game, but also to tell some new stories and provide new insights about these players who were there, some of whom, as you know, were very famous: Mickey Mantle, Jackie Robinson, Yogi Berra, and some, of course, who were not so famous, like Joe Collins, Gil McDougall, Dandy Carey. So it was a mixture of players, but it was an incredible array of talent on the field that day. You had the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Yankees. There is no rivalry in baseball today to compare to that. In the space of 10 years between 1947 and 1956, these two teams faced each other in the World Series six times. And fans were rabidly loyal to each team and hated the other team. And not only that, these were guys, as I say, who were very talented. Seven of the players who were on the field that day were later inducted into the Hall of Fame. And one of them, Gil Hodges, probably should have been.
Right, I was just going to say, there's at least one more and maybe two more who could have been in.
And of the 19 players who were on the field that day, 15 of them had at one point in their career been chosen to play on the All-Star team of their particular league. So, as I say, it was an incredibly talented group of guys. So that was the impetus. And as you say, I wove the stories of these players into the story of the game. And my hope was that the game would have a more human dimension to it, that you would realize, that readers would realize that these people who were on the field, they were just not stick figures. They were real people who had a story behind them.
Well, I think you succeeded in that. Obviously, it's complicated for people who are younger than we are, who for whom this era is less alive. You wonder about that. As you know, when I was a kid, I read about Ty Cobb and Harry Heilman, and players who I'd never would have been able to see, and who by the time I was a young boy, they were all old men. And that's true now of course, many of these guys are actually, they're mostly gone. But I think, if I can imagine myself being a younger baseball fan, this is a really good book to read. And even if I don't know those players in the intimate way that you learn a player who is alive or has played in your own area, your own period of consciousness in baseball, this is a terrific book for to kind of, as you said, to bring these guys to life. They're not just stick figures, and in fact their lives are completely alien to the lives of baseball players today.
Well, that's true, because what it does is, when you learn about the stories behind these players, these 19 players who were on the field that day, it really does, in some respects, reflect what was going on in the country and in the world at that time. These guys all grew up in the Depression. Most of them served in the military during World War II. They came from very tough lives. They played baseball at a time when the owners completely dominated the players' futures. And so they didn't have the bargaining power that players have today. They played, except in a couple of cases, say Mickey Mantle or Yogi Berra, who had substantial salaries, not, relatively speaking, what they would have earned today in the free agency market. But most of these players were at the mercy of the owners. And they had the reserve clause, which enabled the owners to dictate whether and where these players would play. And in fact, one fact, the symptomatic of that, is of the 19 players who were on the field that day, 15 of them had never played for any other team, which shows not only the owner's control over the players, but also the fact that how talented these guys were, because the owners didn't want to let these players go. They didn't want them to play for any other team. And so what you do is you learn about how these guys worked hard and came up in a life that was very challenging to become a major league baseball player, and in most cases a very successful major league baseball player. And they were all the other thing that impressed me was these guys were really tough competitors because it was so hard, it was so important to them to make it. And no matter how successful they were, each of them was in their own respect just a very tough competitor, because of the competition they had to get to where they were, and because winning was so important. The World Series check, which in 1956 was $8,700, which hardly compares to the $350,000 that the Phillies got or the Yankees got this year, but $8,700 for most of these players represented a substantial portion of their year's income or from baseball. So they were really, it was really important for them to get into the World Series and hopefully to win the World Series.
Right. I think that's a real difference. I mean, there's so many differences between the sociology of baseball today and then. Although I think obviously the game itself, the strategy and the method of playing the game is pretty timeless. These kind of other issues are not, and you wonder how they affect how players play. I know a lot of people wonder about that. But you know, the other thing that I was interested in was how many of them, in their early ages of playing, were not identified as great prospects. You know, they kind of accidentally got into the minors. You know, they were signed. They were playing semi-pro. They weren't superstar kids who would have been identified from the early age the way you know, a lot of players are today. And they came up the hard way through these, you know, really tough minor leagues. And you know, as you just pointed out, the competitive drive is really powerful when you come from nothing and you work your way up. Some of these guys were just not, you know, they might have been good athletes, but they weren't identified early as great players, and yet they became great players.
Well, that's true. But some of them had, they all had that. Sal Magley, for instance, the Dodger pitcher in a perfect game, was one of those. They tell a funny story that he really was not that great of a baseball player when he was growing up in Buffalo, or Niagara Falls, rather. And they tell a story about one time he went to a tryout and pitched an inning, and the scout said to him, "Hey, kid, are you going to school?" And he said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "Stay there." And another time he went to a tryout, and he threw three pitches, and then he heard the scout who was monitoring the tryout say, "Next," because they had seen enough of Sal Magley. And it took him a very long time to develop into a pitcher. He turned out to be one of the premier pitchers of the National League in the 1950s, but it was something that didn't come easily. And Hank Bauer, who is the Yankee right fielder, said the same thing. Here is a guy who is incredibly successful as the Yankee right fielder, but he always said, it didn't come easy to me. I really had to work at it, and in terms of hitting and fielding. And so, like you say, it required a lot of hard work, which is, to contrast it with two other players, I would say, is Mickey Mantle and Yogi Berra. Mickey Mantle just had an incredible natural talent to hit the ball, and never could explain it. It was one of those gifts that he was born with. And Yogi Berra, too. Yogi took a lot of time to learn how to become a catcher. That he was not a catcher growing up, and he just became a catcher for some reason when he went into the minor leagues. And he had to work at it. And he would say, in his first couple of years catching for the Yankees, he would candidly say, "I stunk." But as a hitter, he was always had this natural talent to hit the ball and hit it bad pitches over his head, just above the ground, wherever it was. He too just had that natural instinct,
right,
which a lot of the other players did not have.
He's the Vlad Guerrero of his time.
Right.
Well, actually, there were so many details in this book that were just fantastic. I think, you know, you bring up Yogi Berra, the fact that he was a terrible catcher until Bill Dickey taught him.
Right.
And, of course, Bill Dickey is the great catcher of the Yankees from the late 30s and 40s. So there's this tremendous connection between Yogi and the old player. And a lot of the players who were on the field in 1956 had grown up in baseball, you know, under the tutelage of players like Joe DiMaggio, who had retired. But, you talk a lot about their history in the game, which I thought was really terrific. And, of course, Magley, his performance is completely overlooked because, you know, for obvious reasons.
Right.
He didn't win the game, and Larson pitches a perfect game. But at one point they were matching, you know, no-hitter for no-hitter.
That's right.
Magley was, and he was also older at that point. That's the other thing that, you always wonder about is how did Don Larson do this? He was, effectively a journeyman pitcher. He had a lot of promise early, pitched well, but he was, as you point out, he drank a lot. He was a playboy at a certain stage. You know, he was really not a great pitcher. He didn't have a long career of success. This is like one shining moment for him when every single star was aligned in the firmament.
Well, that's no question about it. And I think it just shows, again, how tough competitors, how these guys all were, because Don Larson did not expect to be pitching that day. He came in and started the second game of the World Series, and Casey Stengel, the Yankee manager, took him out before the second inning was over because he had given up a hit and four walks, and Stengel was worried about losing a lead that the Yankees had, which, in fact, they did lose. But and so when Larson performed poorly that day, he thought that his pitching chores for the World Series were over because, first of all, again, this was such an intense rivalry, and so and this was the fifth game of the World Series, and each team had won two games, so it was very important for both sides that they try and win this game and get a 3-2 edge. And the Yankees had a bevy of very good pitchers who had better records during the season than Larson. Larson had done well in the last month of the season when he had turned to a no-wind-up delivery, and I'm sure that's why Stengel started him in the second game. But knowing that Stengel had a lot of other choices, Larson assumed that when he performed poorly in that second game, that was it. And I think all his teammates likewise assumed that was it. And the Yankees had a tradition, which I describe in the book, where the third base coach, Frank Grissetti, would put a ball in the shoe of the player who was going to pitch that day. The attendants would polish the shoes. They'd put them in front of the players' lockers, and Grissetti would put that ball in the shoe of the player who was going to pitch. And Larson, he put the ball into Larson's shoe, and Larson comes in, saunters into the locker room on the morning of that fifth game thinking that he's going to be sitting in the bench or in the dugout or in the bullpen. And he looks, and there is the shoe, the ball, in his shoe. And I talked to Bob Turley, who is a Yankee pitcher, whose locker adjoined Larson's, and Turley said Larson just stared at the ball and gulped. and of course, you know, I talked to these guys like Hank Bauer, Moose Guerin, Bob Turley. They were all flabbergasted and totally puzzled that Stengel had selected Larson to pitch that fifth game because, as I just said, they thought, well, it's an important game. There's a lot of other pitchers who have better records than Larson, and they could not understand why Stengel would do that. But Stengel, there's a lot of stories I tell in the book, but Stengel had this uncanny knack of just knowing when a player might do well, and he would pinch hit in situations that people could not understand and do all kinds of things that were just unfathomable. Just to shift gears a little bit, there was one time when Joe Collins, who was the first baseman and was on a hitting streak and was doing incredibly well, and they got to a series in Detroit, and instead of Collins being on the lineup, Johnny Mize, who was had been picked up from the National League, is playing first base. And Collins said, "I couldn't figure out why Stengel had taken me out of the lineup. I was doing so well." And that day, Johnny Mize hit three home runs.
I remember that story.
And so, same thing here, too. For some reason, Stengel never explained why he chose Larson, but for some reason, I guess he just felt that Larson had it in him to do well. And he obviously did it. And here's Larson in the face of this pressure, this fifth game of this intense rivalry, with each team having won two games, and knowing that not only the series, but the World Series check is on the line. And this guy just rose to the occasion, and I think it reflects, as I said, that he, like his teammates and the other guys on the Dodgers, were tough competitors who could rise to the occasion.
Well, it was an amazing, also a just, you know, incredible accomplishment, but also, you know, you have the luck of great plays being made behind you, catches that you describe. You know, what struck me as I read the book, and this is sort of my, you know, aside from loving the ethos and the feeling that I got of being in that era, which I think you did really well, I had a really strong feeling that the magic of being able to get these hitters out who were so good, you know, who were not giving in. I mean, it's not like anybody was, you know, was off their game or not concentrating. This was a World Series. You had hitters on the other side who were, you know, as you mentioned before, a lot of them are in the Hall of Fame. All of them, almost every one of them, was a good hitter.
Well, you know, the funny thing about that is that, and I just talk about this too in the book, one of the things that surprised me or was interesting to me was the fact that even when they were down to their last out, the Dodgers had never given up hope, and they were circulating in the dugout, and they kept saying, we can beat this guy. They could not believe that Don Larsen would pitch a no-hitter against them. They had been the victims of only one no-hitter in the post-World War II era. And so, as I say, they were circulating in the dugout, and they say, we can win this game. We just got to get somebody on base. Because they were good hitters, they were professionals, they were equally competitive. And so they thought that even when they were down to the last out, there was still time to win the game. Although the other interesting thing to me was the attitude of some of the other Dodgers. As I mentioned in the book, in the left field bullpen, Clem Labine, the Dodger pitcher, was warming up to come in and pitch the bottom of the ninth in the event that the Dodgers did tie the game or pull ahead. But when Dale Mitchell, the Dodger pinch hitter, came up for the last out of the game, Clem Labine realized that he might have an opportunity here to watch a unique event in baseball history. And so he stopped throwing and walks up to the rail, and there standing watching what's going on in the field is a fellow Dodger pitcher, Roger Craig. And Clem Labine looks over to Craig and says, so what do you think, Roger? If Larsen does this, it's probably something we'll never, ever see again in our lifetimes. And again, bearing in mind how intense this rivalry was and how important victory was to both sides, Craig turns over to Labine and says, I hope he does it. And Labine thinks for a second, and he says, you know what? I hope he does it too. Which I thought was a real incredible insight that these guys were putting history above their individual desire for success.
Well, and maybe also the connection between pitchers too.
Right.
That a pitcher is always thinking of, you know, you always want to win your game, but to see another pitcher, even on another team, do something special, you know, maybe there's a kind of camaraderie there among pitchers.
Right. I think that there's something to that. And these players, again, they all knew each other incredibly well because, as I say, they had faced each other six times in 10 years. And so these guys all knew each other. And so I think that might have accounted for it as well.
Well, let me ask you one last question about the book. And it's really about something that I was interested in, and that is the fact that you have a pretty intense full-time job. You know, you're an attorney. You work in a firm. You spent 6 years working on this book. I'm just really curious how you managed to find the time to do this.
Well, you'd be surprised how much time you have if you're disciplined about it and you really want to do something. You start with the fact that this was not a chore for me. This was a real labor of love. I love baseball. I love to write. And so it was a real diversion for me to come home from work or from on a weekend and to get lost, so to speak, in going back to a completely different time and learning about these guys and learning about the game and writing it. And so, like I say, I didn't spend a lot of time watching a lot of sitcoms on television. I didn't spend a lot of time reading novels or reading things that weren't, but were unrelated to the project. And when you are focused that way, as I say, you'd be surprised how much time there is in a day or on a weekend to get some things done. And so that really explains it.
Well, you did a terrific job, and obviously the discipline paid off. You got to talk to some of the players and some of the relatives of players who were there. So, you know, it must have been fun, too.
Oh, yeah, because I talked to all the surviving players and had about 50 interviews, and I talked with a lot of other players who were on the team but not on the field, as well as family members of players who have passed on, like, you know, Jackie Robinson or Roy Campanella, or Mickey Mantle and Billy Morton. And so it was great fun.
Well, it's a terrific book.
If I might mention, too, as if people are interested, they can go to my website, which is lewpaper.com. That's lewpaper.com. Again, lewpaper.com. And you can read about the book. You can read some reviews. And there's even a video there of the last out of the game, which for those who are interested, might be fun to watch.
Well, it's a nice website, too.
And also there's a link to Amazon and other booksellers if they have any interest.
Well, thank you, Lou Paper, for spending some time with me talking about your book, Perfect, Don Larson's Miraculous World Series Game and the Men Who Made It Happen. I enjoyed talking to you. Thanks so much.
Okay, David, thanks for calling.
Take care.
Take care.